Hello and welcome to Talking Tudors, a fortnightly podcast about the ever-fascinating Tudor dynasty. My name is Natalie Gruniger, and I'll be your host and guide on this journey through 16th century England. Are you ready to step through the veil of time into the dazzling and dangerous world of the Tudor court? Without further ado, it's time to talk Tudors. Everyone, welcome back to another episode of Talking Tudors. I'm your host, Natalie Gruniger. Thank you so much for joining me today. I'd like to begin by thanking the sponsor of today's episode, Sandra Bird, author of the Tudor Ladies in Waiting series. A rich alchemy of fact and fiction, these critically acclaimed books chronicle the glittering court lives of three queens and their closest friends and companions. The novels brim with heartwarming and heartbreaking circumstances and heroines who choose lives worth risking all. Book 1, To Die For, follows Queen Anne Boleyn through the viewpoint of Margaret Wyatt. Library Journal awarded it a Best Books of the Year pick and said the novel brings history to life in exquisite detail. Book 2, The Secret Keeper, uncovers love and betrayal in the life of Queen Catherine Parr. Library Journal calls this book atmospheric, full of twists and a must-read for Tudor fiction fans. Finally, Book 3, Roses Have Thorns, draws close to Queen Elizabeth I through Ellen von Snekenborg, who transformed into Helena, the Marchioness of Northampton. I loved all three books and found this concluding book masterful, impeccably researched, and deliciously detailed storytelling. This series is available at Amazon.com. As always, I'd also like to acknowledge and thank the generous listeners who continue to support Talking Tudors on Patreon, and extend a heartfelt thank you to everyone who's taken the time to rate and review the show. If you love the podcast and you never miss an episode, I invite you to join the Talking Tudors Patreon family. Please visit patreon.com/talkingtudors for more information. Join the Talking Tudors family to instantly unlock access to exclusive posts, including audio releases and videos. Patrons are also eligible to attend additional monthly live talks and to enter patron-only monthly giveaways. You can also support the podcast and share your love of Tudor history with the world by buying Talking Tudors merchandise. There are a number of designs and products available, including phone cases, mugs, notebooks, and apparel. Check out all the products at talkingtudors.threadless.com. Now, on to today's episode. I'm absolutely thrilled to welcome John Guy and Julia Fox to the podcast to talk about their new book, Hunting the Falcon, Henry VIII, Anne Boleyn, and the Marriage That Shook Europe. Formerly Provost and History Professor at the University of St Andrews in Scotland, Renaissance historian John Guy is now a Fellow in History at Clare College, University of Cambridge. He has written several books, including Queen of Scots, The True Life of Mary Stuart, upon which the 2018 Mary Queen of Scots, starring Saoirse Ronan and Margot Robbie, was based. He appears regularly on the BBC's flagship cultural programmes. Julia Fox is a teacher and author. She taught history for many years in London, having obtained her degree from the University of London. She's the author of Jane Boleyn, The True Story of the Infamous Lady Rochford, and Sister Queens, Catherine of Aragon and Juana, Queen of Castile. Let's dive straight into our conversation. So welcome back, everyone, to another episode of Talking Tudors. I'm delighted to be joined today by John Guy and Julia Fox. Welcome to the podcast.
Thank you. Well, I'm Julia Fox. I'm passionate about history. I have taught it for, oh gosh, I'd hardly dare say this, 30 plus years in various schools before I wrote my own book. I now live in London with my husband, who's sitting next to me, and our two rescue cats, who I hope won't intrude on this, but I can't promise. You never know. They have occasionally sent emails in error, so we can never be 100% sure.
I'm John Guy. I still teach part-time in Clare College in Cambridge. I've been a Tudor historian and some medieval history for probably 40 plus years. I stopped counting the number of books at 16, but I've written trade biographies on Mary Queen of Scots, on Thomas Becket, Thomas More and his daughter, Margaret More, on the later years of Queen Elizabeth I, and on Thomas Gresham, Elizabeth I's banker. And so this was the first. Julie and I have read each other's work for many years, and we've helped each other a little bit along the way with each other's books.
Well, so we've written little bits in each other
occasionally.
Books,
yeah, this is a news break. We have in the past written passages of each other's books. In some cases, you know, the odd whole chapter, and nobody ever notices. So we thought that we would do this one as a joint enterprise. And in fact, actually, we might talk a little bit about this later. The fact that the pandemic happened to come along just at the time that we were actually starting up on this book also, it meant that actually working together was a great thing.
Yeah, it worked. And we're not getting divorced. So it must have worked.
That's wonderful. And I've been reading your books for many years. So it's such an honor to have you both on the show. And we are here to talk about your latest work that you've just mentioned, which is Hunting the Falcon, Henry VIII, Anne Boleyn, and the Marriage That Shook Europe. So why don't we start by talking a little bit about the importance of Anne Boleyn's time in France, and maybe cover who the women were that surrounded her and some of those really early and important influences.
I don't know how you feel, but I think about, of all of the work that we have done, of all of the research that we've done, this is, I think, the most exciting and in some cases, the most important. When we began this book, we knew, obviously, that this was going to be a romance that was played out in public on Henry's court, often under the very hostile eyes of his courtiers who thought she was, you know, the Wicked Witch of the West, and on the European stage where you've got Francis I and Charles V, who just happens to be Catherine's nephew. But at the heart of it is the story of two people, and they are, both of them, they're not spring chickens. They didn't meet when they were teenagers for, I don't know, a quick kiss behind the 16th century equivalent of the bike sheds. They both come together with backstories. Anne is in her mid-20s by the time that the relationship really takes off. Henry, about 34, 35. So they've got, it's not exactly baggage, but they've got experiences before they meet. And with Anne, what we found, and this is where I think it's terribly important, is that we found things about when she was in France. If you read a biography of Anne Boleyn, they know she went to France when she was, 13. They know she could speak French, that she came back as a sort of honorary French woman in a sense, with French, even a French hood, as the costume, it was her trademark, you know, more flattering than the English gable hood. But it's glossed over. It's often glossed over in about eight lines or a paragraph. And that to us won't do, because she goes out there when she is young, impressionable, and what she sees, what she experiences, shape her. They shape her relationship with Henry. They shape her whole being, and they shape how she behaves as queen. And in fact, they play a part in her downfall. She's experiencing French culture, French music, French books, French fashion, French art. And she also sees the way in which French courts are organized, which are slightly different to the way that English ones are. And while she's there, she meets and is exposed to the actions of some remarkable women. John, do you want to sort of...
Yeah, I mean, I think I totally agree with Julia that character is formed in childhood and adolescence. And these are Anne's adolescent years. And I mean, the first thing to say is that she was right at the centre of power, because she was with Queen Claude. I mean, Julia's absolutely right. I mean, the best, you know, if you like, biography of Anne that's appeared in the last 20, 30 years is Eric Ives's. And, you know, he gives you, you know, it's an encyclopedia in so many ways and a remarkable piece of work. But he's got about 10 pages on Anne in France. And so to redo the missing years, that was always high on the agenda. So from the very beginning, our focus was France. Okay, so that meant we were going to be doing, and this is, of course, where our timing wasn't great because of the start of the pandemic. We needed to do 6 months work in French archives, but maybe we'll talk about that later. Okay, so Anne is with Queen Claude. She is Queen Claude's demoiselle, which means she's one of the maids of honor. And the thing about Queen Claude is that in France, the household wasn't always with the kings. The kings often went off separately. And so the key to understanding, first of all, where Anne was physically was to do an itinerary. And in fact, you know, amazingly, that became possible because we discovered that Chancellor Duprat's secretary, a guy called Jean de Barillon, kept a journal which actually records where the queens and the king's household vary in those itineraries. Okay, so first we've got the itinerary. And then, of course, we start to work on the people. And of course, we discover that in France, these women around the king, particularly Queen Claude, obviously because he was Francis I's wife. Of course, she was more or less the same age as Anne. She wasn't much older than, but she was Anne of Brittany's daughter. And Anne of Brittany, of course, was one of the most powerful women in late 15th, early 16th century France, with remarkable art collections, book collections, but a woman who knew how to exercise power. She had people around her who, you know, we would designate as proto-feminists. But even more so, Louise of Savoy, the king's mother, was very much involved in French government, French politics. She was on the Conseil Privé, that's the Privy Council. She was regent when Francis was out of the country. She acted independently. Yeah. Of Francis, and they worked together as a team.
And so did
Marguerite of Angoulême, Francis's sister. And what we learnt is that these women would waft in and out, if you like, of Claude's apartments. They were close. Marguerite of Angoulême was in a spectacular ceremony in 1517 at her estates in Argentan, while Anne was present, made Duke of Berry in her own right. She was made Duke of Berry in her own right with lands, if you like, annuities, cash, but also the grant specifically meant that she could sit on the Conseil Privé. She also, these rights did not pass to her husband. Mm. She had them independently. And in fact, you know, it's actually then rather striking when you realize that Anne Lewis later created Marquess of Pembroke in her own right in a ceremony absolutely modeled and with a grant, which was essentially the template of which was Marguerite's creation as Duke of Berry, and with the guest of honor as the then French ambassador. So, I mean, Marguerite of Angoulême too, I mean, she acted independently. Admittedly, while Francis was out of the country, when he was in captivity after the Battle of Pavia, Marguerite actually went to Spain to try to negotiate with Charles for his freedom. So Anne saw all these women acting in this way. Marguerite of Angoulême was also very much a proto-feminist. She knew, you know, she wrote extensively, admittedly later, but we believe that many of the views that she formed, I mean, she was very candid about men's behavior within the frame of courtly love. You know, they want sex without strings, whether a woman's married or not. And the woman always gets the blame. And often priests are the worst because, they, you know, it's easier for them to cover it up. I mean, she writes absolutely, you know, I mean, phenomenal stuff. And they talked about this stuff in not only the Queen's Chamber, but in the Queen's Privy Chamber. In France, they had different names. There was the Chambre à Paris and the Chambre de Retraite. Mm. But the thing is that the demoiselles were always with the Queen. So where the Queen was, so Anne didn't need to eavesdrop on this stuff or hear it through gossip. No. She was actually on a cushion with the demoiselles, sat on cushions near the Queen, actually at the time. So she saw these women acting independently. As Julius said, she saw a different sort of corporal protocol. In France, the women could basically have men coming into not only the Queen's chamber, almost at will, but also within the Chambre de Retraite, the Privy Chamber, obviously not into the bedchamber, but there was much more freedom, which was, of course, why there was much more talk of sex scandals in 16th century France, particularly later on, actually. Look at Court of Mary, Queen of Scots, you know, where, you know, basically it was very easy to accuse the Queen of basically goings on in the Privy Chamber because, you know, men like David Rizzio, the Queen's secretary, just wandered in and out of there because, you know, that was how things were in France. And so Anne experienced that, and that influenced her.
Would influence her a great deal later as Queen and play a part in her downfall.
but also the love of French books and fine manuscripts. And of course, what was said about Anne was that, you know, she was never to be seen without a French book in her hand. And of course, particularly increasingly books on religion. And here, let's just take Anne's religion as a sort of, as also another way into this, because again, astonishingly, you see, I mean, people just didn't ever read this stuff. I don't know whether they thought it was difficult to find or not possible to find. But when Francis, quite early in his reign, he went to Italy and he basically he captured Milan. And as he was coming back, Claude, Louise, Marguerite, they go to meet him. And Anne is with Claude. And when they get to the south of France, they're on their way to Aix-en-Provence. They go to the shrine of Mary Magdalene, or the supposed shrine of Mary Magdalene, at the basilica of a church called Saint Maximin de Saint-Baume. There's a sort of grot or grotto, a cave above. You climb up the, as it were, pathway up the sort of up the cliff, and you see the grot. And they went to this shrine, and they were very impressed by this. But afterwards, Louise of Savoy wanted to know more about the stories of Mary Magdalene and if they were true, because Mary Magdalene was a remarkable saint because she just rescued people, you know, it says got people sort of instantly saved after living lives of debauchery. And, you know, it was a sort of particularly sort of suspect sort of miracle tradition. And she had this, she asked her chaplain to have this investigated. Well, it was a bit too strong and potentially iconoclastic for the chaplain, but he called in Jacques Lefebvre d'Etaples, who was his mentor, and Denis Brissonnet, who was the brother of Guillaume Brissonnet, of course, who was soon becoming the leader of the French reforming movement. And of course, Jacques Lefebvre d'Etaples was the inspiration of the French reforming movement. And Anne, Jacques did impromptu seminars for Louise and Claude. And you know, she was there on her cushion. And so the whole development of Anne's religion and her Francophile, you know, position all stem from these years. And this is sort of spectacular stuff because, remember, if you're English, you're Francophobe. You're culturally Francophobe. I mean, the traditional English alliance was with Flemish Burgundy, you know, because of culture, dynasty, and also trade, which then, of course, meant essentially the logic was for an Anglo-Habsburg alliance because the Habsburgs basically took over Flemish Burgundy, and Charles V then became King of Spain. But also, of course, he was Duke of Burgundy, and then he became Holy Roman Emperor. So the whole logic, and of course, when Anne came back from France, which was, and we know exactly when that was, because Francis actually says it, and he says so in a way that makes it clear that he actually knew who Anne was. It wasn't just,
and that's quite,
it wasn't just this English girl who was with the Queen. He knows who Anne. He knows who Anne is. And of course, something else we discovered was that Claude's sister, Renée, in Elizabeth's reign, absolutely remembered Anne as being, you know, very close and with Queen Claude, and tells the English ambassador of the time about that. And that was a little bit of a find.
Very much so.
So, you know, when you start this, I mean, you probably wondered this yourself, and I'm sure a lot of listeners have wondered about this. How on earth was it? Why was it that if Anne was such a sort of absolute, you know, sort of, if you like, sex bomb, if you want to stereotype it, or sort of femme fatale, and she comes back from France, which we know to have been around Christmas 1521. How on earth was it that it took Henry over 4 years even to notice her? I mean, he noticed her sister, but he didn't notice Anne. Well, of course, this is where the work that we did on the diplomatic archives comes into its own, because, of course, it's exactly at the moment that Henry sees Anne that England switches to a pro-French policy and ditches the Habsburgs.
Yes, it's so fascinating, and it's such a crucial period. I completely agree with you, and I'm so glad that you've dedicated so much time to this in your wonderful book. So let's talk a little bit more about those sources, the ones that you've uncovered and also the ones that you've reinterpreted, I suppose, and what they actually tell us about Anne.
Okay, well, I mean, in some ways, we've sort of partly dealt with this because no British historian really has, well, I'm sort of tempted to say made the effort, but it hasn't sort of occurred to people. They think this is an English story with sort of, if you like, European observers. They haven't realized that it's a European story, not just an English story. Yes. And so the natural place, of course, I knew this because of working on Mary, Queen of Scots. You head off to the Rue de Richelieu in Paris, where the manuscript department of the Bibliothèque Nationale is. Because in France, most of the ambassador's papers are actually not in the Archives Nationales, as they would be in the UK, but they're in the Bibliothèque Nationale. And there are hundreds of manuscripts. There are thousands of pages. And there are, if you like, the dozens of manuscripts there that actually bear on the story of Henry and Anne. Secondly, until very recently, the French diplomatic archives, if you like, by which I mean treaties, copies of treaties, some preliminary notes for treaties, they were all in the basement of the Ministère des Affaires étrangères, the Ministry of Foreign Affairs. But those all got shunted down to La Courneuve a few years ago. But of course, those contain copies of treaties and subsidiary papers in connection with treaties that are either lost or illegible in the English archives. But the particular one, there's a really major treaty, which is a pivot of our story, which was a full offensive and defensive alliance between England and France, the only one that had ever been so far, since the Norman conquest in 1532, which, by the way, is the prelude to Anne becoming made Marquess of Pembroke.
Yeah.
So tied to these bonds.
Yeah. And Catherine finally
chucked out and told not to live in Henry's properties, but basically to clear off to Bugden and then Kimbolton. The timing fits perfectly. Those are actually now at La Courneuve. And then for Anne's time in France, this is where the pandemic inadvertently, yeah. I mean, a horrible thing it was, but it did us a big favor in the sense that here we are, able to work on what we've got, but essentially having to work essentially on our own computers and on online. The French were absolutely brilliant. We wrote to the BNF, we wrote to French Ministry of Foreign Affairs, we wrote to quite a few local archives. They all responded, either gave us links or digitized our stuff. And, unlike, I have to say, rather shamefully in the UK, where they would digitize stuff but take sort of months or years and at fabulous prices, they did it all within 3 to 5 months and at very modest cost for us. But of course, also we had to trawl what had already been printed. And it was then that we discovered that there's a whole sort of almost like library archive of a small local French historical and archaeological societies, topographical societies of the 19th century, from tiny little places, in Normandy, in Brittany, in the south of France, wherever it is, really tiny places. They don't, in the 21st century, this stuff doesn't continue in that way. But here are all these people, publishing their archives, writing stuff. And of course, we were able to find lots and lots of the places at which Claude had made royal entries, entrées royales, into French towns, with Anne with her.
Yes.
And sometimes it even specifies, and there was a carriage for the demoiselle, This was absolutely fabulous, fabulous, fabulous stuff. And then, I mean, there's lots of things we found, but I think something that actually has significance is that, as your listeners will know, I mean, whether or not the records for Anne's trial and George's trial and those of the four commoners, whether they were somehow sanitized or doctored, by Cromwell or later by Elizabeth I to remove, things that people, for the different reasons, didn't want to see. We've always found that rather incredible because if you look at these sources, what's there now is exactly what ought to have been there. But in a very obscure class in the National Archives at Kew, we stumbled into a list of what was in Henry's state papers in 1544. That's before he's even dead, when papers were moved into a new, storeroom in the secret chair house above the King's study at Whitehall Palace. And they include papers, a little coffer of Master Norris's writings.
Coffer of Lady Rochford.
Coffer of Lady Rochford's writings. And this sort of thing. Now, that Lady Rochford's writings clearly refer to Catherine Howard's trial and not to... But Henry Norris's writing must refer to the trial of 1536.
Yes.
And so pursuing this line, we discovered that the interrogations, the pre-trial interrogations, were not only happened, but were more extensive than we had supposed. But in 1544, some of those, if not all of those papers, still existed in the King's archive. If they had been in Cromwell's archives, they moved after Cromwell's execution into the King's archives, as was the case with convicted traitors. But of course, you know, there was a big fire in 1619 at Whitehall Palace. Rodents and, you know, damp and, you know, everything was extremely, you know, meant that record survival was extremely spasmodic. So there was nothing sinister, I think, in the way that that evidence was...
It just disappeared.
Simply disappeared. But on the other hand, we know that now that it was more extensive, yes. And that also that enabled us to refocus how we looked at the trials.
Yes, I'd agree completely with that. I mean, clearly Lady Rochford's is not to do with it, but and we'll never know. I mean, it's intriguing, you know, if only we could find what Norris said. As far as reinterpreting sources that are already there, I think one of the first things and one of the most important things is, and I have to say it rather shocked me actually, is that Anne had limited control of the women around her in her privy chamber. You think that she would be able to say, okay, I'm queen, I want lady this, lady that, lady whatever, to come and attend me. No. For a start, Henry had a complete and utter veto over anybody in there. I mean, indeed, you know, in France, some of the attendants were literally sent back by Louis XII when Mary Tudor married him. So he's got that veto. But you've got a collection of women, some of whom she did have that were her friends or her family. She relied a lot on family. Her sister-in-law, Jane Parker, Lady Rochford, her own sister, Mary Boleyn, for some time until Mary disgraces herself by marrying William Stafford, her mother, Mary Fitzroy, who was, or Mary Howard, whichever way you want to look at it, who was the wife of Fitzroy, Henry's illegitimate son. Mary Shelton, who is one of my particular favourites, quite a goer, I think, Mary Shelton. Very, very interesting woman. But there are also those who are basically career courtiers. People like Lady Kingston, the Constable of the Tower's wife, Jane Calthorpe, who was once Princess Mary's governess, Lady Boleyn, Anne's aunt,
Elizabeth Boleyn,
yeah, who Anne didn't like. And it's infuriating. We don't know why they didn't get on, but they didn't. And it's significant that of the women who were sent to look after, guard Anne in the Tower, Lady Boleyn was one of them. Certainly not a friend. And we know about these different women and the different roles that they played, because if you look at the gift roles, particularly the one of 1534, when Anne was actually queen, you can see, to cut a long story short, you can see how they're grouped. So when Anne is in her chamber, she is surrounded by women, yes, but some of them will be hostile. They'll be watching everything she does, everything she says. They'll be looking every month. They know everything. They will know every single month whether she has menstruated, whether she is pregnant. And they'll be watching, and they will be watching with hostile eyes.
Because the career courtiers were Catherine of Aragon's courtiers who've been passed over. Yeah.
And many of them will elide very smoothly into Jane Seymour's household, because, you know, that's the way it worked. So that, to me, I thought was really interesting, that Anne would have to be forever looking over her shoulder. You can never be quite sure who is listening. And Henry's court is claustrophobic. You can't get away from it. You don't know who's around the next corner. Unfortunately, Anne tended to forget that a little bit and could sometimes overstep the mark, as she does later on with the gentlemen coming in, the French influence, you see, the way in which they did this in France. And that, of course, is very important. So that, to me, looking at that gift role, don't you think, John? But also what's important, I think, is one of the people who's largely airbrushed out of Anne's story is her brother, George Boleyn. He sort of flits in and out. And at the end of it, he's accused of incest. A very, very clever touch, that, because it's such a heinous crime. And he can get chopped with her. But what we really found was the way in which he was there constantly. The Boleyns, obviously, it's a family firm. Royal families, presumably, and various other families frequently are. But George, her younger brother, is central. He is sent on various missions to France, not always successful. But he and his sister are close. On one particular occasion, when things have gone badly in France. He dashes back to give the news to Henry. But before he goes to the king, he goes into his sister and he spends some time with Anne. She's in a filthy temper afterwards, apparently, telling her, you know, sorry, things haven't gone right in France. And of course, that also will come, is important because it shows that the two were together alone. Sometimes you would be with your brother, I mean, for goodness sake. But if you're looking at incest charge, that's about the only instance we could find where they were actually definitely alone. But he is flitting in and out of her privy chamber. He's very important with the French diplomacy. He's important, too, with some of the diplomacy that Henry conducts with the church here. And he perhaps could have been seen as a potentially, I don't think he was quite at the time, a potentially big player. If, for example, he had survived Anne's execution and not become involved in it, I think he would have been very dangerous. And the person, of course, who comes out trumps after Anne's execution is Cromwell. And what Cromwell will not want is a rival, particularly a rival with a grudge, you know, the size of an elephant or the size of the sword wielded by the French executioner. So I think that was something that we were particularly interested in, because I think it just sort of, it puts a different light on things to show that she isn't just blithely going along in the privy chamber, happily, you know, happy as the day is long. She's not. She's watching over her shoulder. She's insecure. And when she's insecure, she lashes out. And until she had a son, you know, the good old male heir, she will always be insecure. And she'll always lash out. Do you think, why should I?
Yes, no, else? I mean, George goes on 6 missions to France, but he's in the vanguard of the Berlin policy. And when you refocus all this, because of the French diplomatic records, some of this is in the English records too, but people didn't really sort of pick it out. You can see Anne pursuing, particularly when she and Henry are striving for the same joint enterprise for divorce. But Anne, like Louise of Savoy or Marguerite of Angoulême, is allowed and in fact freely runs an independent almost diplomacy.
People report
her right back to her. And also they come back from Europe and report to her first and then go and see Henry.
Or sometimes Henry sends them to see her.
Or sometimes Henry sends them to see her to report fully and says, you can see me later, go and see her now. She's going to be, you know, interested in this stuff. But also around the time of the coronation and Anne's coronation and afterwards, a central Berlin policy is to try and persuade Francis I to break with Rome with the Pope too. And George is at the forefront of this.
Yes.
And that is why Cromwell, by the time Cromwell is secretly talking to Eustace Chapuis, the imperial ambassador, actually, because in fact he's not actually, Chapuis is not Spanish, he's Savoyard. But at the time that Cromwell is talking to Chapuis, he actually specifically, right from the beginning, it tells Chapuis, well, you know, don't worry, I'll make sure that George Boleyn is never sent to France again, and that Anne is cut out of, you know, this diplomatic chain, which he proceeds to do. I mean, during the 1535 progress to Bristol, but it's delayed, it takes place, but it's extended and goes into Hampshire, and it goes down to Winchester, and then it goes to one of the Seymour houses, and then and at that time, just after Winchester, Anne tries to send a message back to Marguerite of Angoulême. And I think at the time, I think it's Francis Bryan. Anyway, somebody's in France at the time. And Cromwell says, report only back to me. I think it is Bryan. Report only back to me and make sure that basically, you know, that sort of approach between Anne and so on is not answered. The whole George thing, you know, it's all sort of there, but you have to, it's not that you have to know to look for it, but
you have to look for
him. When you see it, you have to see it for what it is and not just be bound by, you know, what's been said before. I had the same thing during when I was doing Mary Queen of Scots. You know, I mean, I would never have thought of writing a book on Mary Queen of Scots until I happened to go into the archives because the BBC had asked me to go and look for something because they were doing a doc and they couldn't find some of the things they wanted. And I walk in and I look at these volumes and I see absolutely astonishing stuff that doesn't map in any way, you know, onto the sort of history that I've been teaching for the last 20 years. It's something that's completely different. You know, and, you know, here's a queen who knows her own mind, who's actually politically quite astute, you know, unlucky, and the odds are stacked against her, but all of those things. You suddenly see that if you go back and look at this stuff with a fresh eye, You know, I mean, it's completely different. It's not just moving the deck chairs about. No. I mean, it's completely refurnishing the
buying the deck
you
chairs.
Know the apartment. But I mean, on reinterpreting well-known sources too. I mean, I think I don't want to talk too long about this because it's quite fully explained in the book. But the whole question of who gave evidence at the trials has been spooked for ages by all sorts of sort of mistake assumptions.
Well, the fact that I think we just ought to say really here that the fact that Jane Boleyn ends up getting chopped, if you like,
Viscountess
for what
Rochford,
she did, Viscountess Rochford, if you want to call her that, ends up getting chopped for her part in the Catherine Howard debacle, means that you have got a scapegoat for Anne's execution, because if you're looking at this later on, you're not going to say Henry did anything wrong or that Anne did anything wrong because Elizabeth's on the throne, for goodness sake. But there you've got your scapegoat. And I think that has made people a little bit more lazy in looking into who might have given evidence. Whereas if you go back, do you want to mention Hussey?
Well, I think what I was going to say specifically was, because we could get a bit bogged down
in
the small print of all of this. But the essential,
I have to
the, one of the essential, with the essential well, you were absolutely game, right to do that. Because one of the essential sources that everybody knows and everybody cites is this letter of the so-called Portuguese general,
which
of course doesn't mention it. It says that person, but actually the in the Portuguese original, that person is feminine. So it clearly is a woman, but no woman is named.
Yeah.
But
no matter what anybody says.
But of course this all... Well, not exactly goes up in a puff of smoke when you actually realise that there was no such Portuguese gentleman. He doesn't exist. Writing a letter to a friend in the country or in another country is a standard rhetorical newsletter technique from the age of Cicero onwards. And in fact, the letter of the Portuguese gentleman is one more version of a European newsletter that was doing the rounds, that was based on an original Paris newsletter, which was probably written by the secretary to the then French ambassador in London, a guy called Lancelot de Carle, who also wrote a very famous poem on the history of Anne Boleyn. But there are actually notes which I believe are by de Carle and which are were sort of used for the poem, but were also used for this Paris newsletter. And they're in the Bibliothèque Nationale. And, you know, I mean, you've got to sort of piece it all together, but there's absolutely no question that the Portuguese gentleman's letter is just one version of a common European newsletter, which is
doing the rounds,
you know, with some bits added and some bits removed. And they all go back to a single source. So these things don't corroborate each other. It's a single source that needs corroboration. Yeah, I mean, de Carle is a fascinating figure because the tantalizing thing, because I know about a little bit about Thomas More, having worked on him before I really started working on Mary Queen of Scots. And there's a very famous Paris newsletter describing the trial of Thomas More, very, very famous, clearly by somebody who was a Frenchman who was actually present. I in fact, it's in the same, there's a very good copy in the same manuscript as the manuscript with this account of Anne and George's executions and some other things about that are rather crucial about them. And I actually now have come to think, although this is not for this particular book, but it's simply more general, that de Carle also wrote the Paris newsletter. But of course, he could well have been present at More's trial. He could well have been present at Anne's trial because, there were lots of people present in the King's Hall at the Tower, for Anne's trial. And of course, he could even, despite what everybody says, he could even just conceivably have seen the execution, because although foreigners were to be excluded, we now found out from Anthony's notes, which are now, you can trace those back through notes in the Bodleian Library in Oxford, that actually not all foreigners were kept out and some had crept in. So being able to sort of pin that down. I mean, another thing that emerged from that was that, there's this great argument. Was it Elizabeth Brown, Countess of Worcester, or was it Lady Bridget Wingfield, Lady Wingfield, Bridget Wilshire, Lady Wingfield, who basically put the boot into to Anne? Well, of course, with the new materials before us, These are not incompatible. No. It's perfectly possible that Elizabeth
can
Brown,
be both.
As
why must it be one or
as
the
Hussey,
other?
As Hussey says, yeah. The Lyle's court agent says, Elizabeth Brown was the first, so if you like, first cause. But then this letter of Bridget Wiltshire, Lady Weed, was introduced during the trial as evidence. The things
by Spellman, who
perfectly
wrote
accountable.
One of
by the way, I mean, I think many of your listeners will be quite interested to see that Bridget Wiltshire is a character right almost in this book, almost flitting in and out, right from the start.
Yes,
when Anne was a child in Kent, because she clearly is quite an important part in the story. So it's old materials, new materials. Sort of by the time we got to the end, we couldn't even tell which is which, because you look at old things in this new way, as I did with Mary Queen of Scots, and then the new things provide mutual context and mutual reinforcement,
because you want to look at the whole
and
thing
the whole
in the
thing
round.
Comes together
I think that's very, very important. I mean, you've spoken about Anne's religious beliefs a bit that she got from France.
It would be lovely to hear a little bit more about that, because I think there is still some confusion as to what Anne believed or didn't believe.
Yeah, I mean, Chapuis kept saying she was a Lutheran, and lots of people still say that to us now, don't they?
Yes.
You know, would we write 1,000 words on Anne's Lutheranism? actually, that would be very difficult, because she wasn't.
She rejected Lutheranism. Partly because of the work of James Carley.
Yes,
on the books which had been once owned by Anne and George. We know a lot more about these books, and we've looked into this also quite ourselves quite a lot more, and into exactly what they were and where they came from. But of course, now, knowing as we do now that Anne had been exposed to Jacques Lefebvre d'Etaples, almost right from the beginning through Louise of Savoy and the women and this pilgrimage to Ximène-la-Sainte-Baume, because we know about that. And of course, George could have collected some of these books when he went to France. John Barlow, who was the Boleyn chaplain, who Anne, basically became a patron of. He was used during the divorce constantly to go across to and from Rome and deliver things to, as a courier, to deliver things to agents and ambassadors in Rome or in France or whatever. And he could have picked up things for Anne. We know that Anne was buying books in France. I mean,
and George is madly
interested more
himself.
There's more than
I think he's more extreme than Anne, isn't he?
Yes, there's more
and
than
Chapuis. Remember when Chapuis actually says, the trouble with George is even if you have dinner with him, he can't stop talking about religion.
Yeah, but they've got 40 or 50 of these books, and they're not Lutheran books. They're books either from the sort of Brissonnet circle or more often from the circle around Jacques Lefebvre d'Etaples. She has his two-volume translation of the Bible. I mean, she also has Tyndale's as well. But of course, Tyndale's is published by one of the very same printers that prints the book. Simon Dubois is one of the big printers of these books by Lefebvre, but so is Martin Lampreur. That's a sort of an AKA. Martin Deleuze is Martin Lampreur. I think his name is De Keyser. It's in the book. He printed the copy of Tyndale's Bible that Anne has. So again, it's got a sort of although Tyndale's Bible has Lutheran connotations, sort of big time, it's printed by one of the people who print the French books. But Anne refused Tristram Revel's book, refused to patronize it because it was Lutheran.
Yeah.
There's been this sort of, war of attrition for almost 30 years. Between Eric Ives, who definitely on the right side of the argument that Anne was a reformer, pointing to the influence of France and the Cercle de Meaux but of course he was relying very much on the influence of Marguerite of Angoulême, and of course it was very easy then, not knowing what Anne was doing in France and who she was seeing and who she was with, to say, but Marguerite of Angoulême didn't get interested in this reform cause until really the time that Anne is leaving France. And there's a little bit of it. There's truth in that. But then when you look and see what we have found, you can see that Claude and Louise were interested. And Claude was doing things like trying to reform monasteries and do things for education and poor relief. The essence of Lefebvre was that it was a reform. It wasn't anti-papal as such. It thought that true religion was down to the motives and mindsets of those people who were involved. So in fact, if you did charitable works, if you did good works, it wasn't just to do good works to ease your passage through purgatory. It was because you were of that sort of mindset and that sort of charity, and you had faith. Mm. And the Gospels and the Epistles of St. Paul's, those were the key things, which they also were for Luther. But Lefebvre d'Etaples rejected the German sort of doctrines that were sort of condemned as heretical. I mean, you know, I mean, the Sorbonne was always after them, but Louise was protecting them, and Marguerite of Arc was protecting them. And so Anne saw all.
And she's not anti-monastery.
She's
such.
Not anti-monastries, no.
She wants them to be pure. She wants them to live up to the proper monastic ideals.
And for some of them to be to have their wealth, if they weren't sort of basically doing their job properly, to have their wealth basically redirected towards education and poor religion, which she starts to do. But then Cardinal Wolsey had done that, and no one's going to say that he was a Protestant or the Lutheran. It was a perfectly reasonable thing to do to try and reach the founder's intentions. But it's motive. When they talk about mindset, it's charity, but it's the mindset, it's the frame of mind in which you make these gifts, and that's the sort of the test. You've got this Christian spirit, this true Christian sort of. If Erasmus called it the philosophy of Christ, to sort of do that to do that in the right way. So you know, we sort of find it bizarre that you've got Eric Ives, who was quite a really good friend of mine. And he's no longer with us. He was the great historian, but sort of batting away for the reform cause. And then you've got Professor Bernard, George Bernard, on the other side saying that Anne was just basically a Catholic because she believed in monasteries. And well, of course she did, because the Lefebvres did believe, they did. They just wanted to sort of, if you like, streamline them in the right way. And Skip's sermon is something that Anne just weaponizes, the sermon that Skip preached, to the whole court.
Not long before her fall.
And of course, what we also discovered was this just wasn't ranting. This wasn't just ranting in a vacuum, because Anne, was cross because, Henry had put this bill to confiscate the wealth of the smaller monasteries, but actually to then funnel it into the royal coffers and not to reform of education and poor relief and socially beneficial purposes. The sort of thing that she was involved with the William Marshall Poor Relief Plan, which we actually think was done, and we think Anne knew about it and supported it. But that sermon that Skip preached was just a few days, I think it's what is it, something like 10 days before that for the smaller monasteries was due to be ratified. Yeah. So this wasn't just a sort of rant at something that had happened as a fait accompli.
Yeah.
This was basically a plea from the heart, to Henry to basically sort of, reverse this and see the error of his ways and turn it back. But of course, at the moment it was misjudged.
Talk to us a little bit about Anne's coronation and why it's a unique event in British history, and perhaps also what it tells us about Anne and Henry's relationship.
When we're thinking in terms of how Henry feels about Anne and vice versa, which I think is quite important too. The coronation, I think, is very, very important here. I mean, obviously, to start with, it's a spectacular coronation. How coronations operated was very, very much within prescribed limits. There was a manuscript of 1308 kept at Westminster Abbey, which said the protocol for the actual coronation itself. There was something that we always call the Royal Book, which had rules and regulations, protocols for all sorts of royal events. And it basically said, she's a queen consort, let's face it, maybe about 3 days for this. Anne gets a 5-day celebration, and probably at a cost of, according to the then Milanese ambassador at the time, he thought it was about 65 million ducats. It comes to about £65 million today. So it's expensive. It begins with a massive river flotilla and procession, loads of little boats, about 300, I think, 320, actually, if my memory serves me right, all decorated with little bells and pennants. There was this wonderful barge with a mechanical dragon belching fire, that sort of thing. Most of the boats stayed well away from that just in case, because it was powered by gunpowder. And Anne's wonderful barge, which, by the way, she pinched from Catherine and had Catherine's arms removed from. And then she goes to the tower where Henry, who's sneaked on ahead, greets her briefly. He stays out of most of this because it's Anne's time. And then you've got the processions into London a couple of days later with the pageants, many of which are traditional, many of which, however, are not and are more classically inspired because, of course, this is the Renaissance, Anne's time in France, exposure to new ideas. But it's the coronation itself. When Anne is crowned, and I had noticed this years ago when I wrote on Jane, she is crowned not with the consort's crown. She does not sit on a consort's chair. When Cranmer places the crown on Anne's head, it is St. Edward's crown. She sits on St. Edward's chair, the coronation chair. In other words, she is crowned as though she is a queen regnant, not a queen consort. And that, I think, is very important. And it's also true that round about, probably just before this, and probably not for very long, it is likely that Henry saw Anne as his co-ruler. He would give her perhaps set areas to deal with, you know, maybe social reform, that sort of thing. He rewrote part of the coronation oath. Sadly, we've only got one page of that remaining.
Well, that's the problem. He rewrote all of it, but we've only got page one.
Yeah. Oh, gosh, it's infuriating. But I think the coronation does show just how important Anne is to Henry and what he really did think. I do think she's the love of his life. Whether he is the love of hers is another matter. Mm. But I think, did you want to add anything on the coronation?
Well, I would sort of sum it up like this, and we sort of agonised over this quite a lot. There's a lot to be said for taking the view, and we do take the view, because up to this point, Anne had been independently pursuing, you know, objectives which were common to them both, but which she could pursue independently, as she had seen in happening in France. We think that up to the coronation itself, there's quite good reasons for suspecting, but you can't prove it, unfortunately. You don't have the sort of, if you like, the killer document, the killer proof, that one, Henry was planning to have a joint coronation, which would include recrowning himself, which is not, in the Middle Ages, that's not an uncommon thing. Mm. A joint coronation with new oaths, and that he was seriously contemplating making Anne some sort of basically co-sovereign. He must have envisaged her as sovereign, because he wouldn't have crowned her with St. Edward's crown.
And I mean, she's the only one.
I mean, that has to be unprecedented in the whole of British history.
Yeah.
I mean, when, you know, I mean, Camilla was crowned the other day in Westminster Abbey. You know, she was on a consort's chair. She got a consort's crown.
Yes.
You know, I mean, it was of a completely different order. And
so it's got to be significant.
This is a bit. And of course, I mean, the one thing that Henry knew about, because of, the divorce and his whole way that he was taught to think about imperial kingship and, you know, his powers against the Pope, he knew about sort of Byzantine history. And of course, in the Byzantine Empire, the emperor and the empress often ruled together as co-rulers. But we just don't have, unfortunately, we just don't have those missing pages. We just don't have. So you just can't take that one any further. So it's just, not exactly a loose end, because it can't ever be closed. But that's a unique. That coronation is a unique event. And although, I mean, we have a chapter on called The Ambassadors, which is, there's a lot in it about, we reinterpret Holbein's painting, The Ambassadors. And I think you need to read that in the book, because it needs to be sort of seen on the page in conjunction with the picture.
Yeah.
But and of course, the main ambassador who is depicted in there, Jean de Danteville, the French ambassador at the time of the coronation, who was, of course, guest of honour actually at the coronation also itself. He was known to be someone who had sympathies with the Lefebvre's reform and all of that. But of course, the problem was that his boss, this is what was overlooked, his boss was the Duke Morancy, Anne de Montmorency, the Grand Master of France, who was not a Lefebvreist, who was conservative. And of course, at that time, the Boleyn policy was very much towards getting Francis to break with Rome. There was a conference coming up at, it was planned for Nice, but was finally held in Marseille, and the Boleyns really wanted to get Francis to have a showdown with the Pope. And that never happened, because Francis wanted to marry his second son, Henri, Duke of Orléans, to the Pope's niece, to Clement the VII's niece, Catherine de Medici. And so France, you know, rather pragmatically put its own interests. Francis was supporting Henry. He thought Henry had been shabbily treated. But the thing about the ambassador's portrait is that all this stuff about, you know, the lute with the broken string, the consort of flutes, which has one missing, so the consort can't be played, pages from the Lutheran hymnal, all of these things which sort of suggest sort of fracture in Christendom and the threat of reform, these things sort of into it. I mean, even the shepherd's dial, the sort of the clock timepiece, is set to the time when people are waiting for the verdict at Dunstable to come through on Catherine's divorce. You know, the pavement, the Cosmati pavement, is the one on which Anne was crowned on the sovereign's chairs.
Which you can just see.
There's something coming out of here, which we discuss in quite a bit of depth in the book, that the risk that people like de Danteville and his brother Francois, who had also been the French agent in Rome, what they saw was that the unity of Christendom could collapse because of this Berlin policy of getting Francis to break with Rome. That was dangerous. You know, it had the sort of 16th century potential, because given the explosive nature of religion, of the sort of a sort of 16th century version of the Cuban Missile Crisis, a sort of standoff, you know, which was, how was this all going to end? But Julia's absolutely right. I mean, this was absolutely her research, you know, which she'd first touched on when she did that.
Yeah,
book.
I don't think I realized at the time when I first found it, you know, some years ago.
How cosmic it was.
No, but it really is. I hadn't, you know, I'll be very honest, I hadn't realized about the reframing of the coronation oath at the time. Okay, I know we've only got the one page, but the fact that he was doing anything on that, I didn't know. And now that I do, I can see even more clearly just how important that is.
Well, usually you do that sort of thing because you think you might need it. And since it just so happens that there's a coronation coming up, do you connect the dots? Do you connect the dots or not? But the trouble is that you've got to be careful in this business because you can get a little bit carried away.
I think this leads actually really nicely into the next question that I wanted to ask you. And that is, did Anne exert real influence over Henry and the politics of the time?
I mean, ironically, up to that time, the answer is absolutely yes. Yeah. I mean, the divorce campaign is a joint enterprise. I mean, during the sweating sickness, Henry was even, you know, we mentioned it in the book, we should have flagged it up more than we actually did. Henry was actually sending state papers down to Hever to be vetted by Anne.
Yeah. Because there's no other chief minister. People tend to think Wolsey falls, Cromwell comes in. No.
Because Cromwell is not chief. And I mean, this becomes increasingly apparent also because Dermot McCulloch, you know, whose magisterial book on Cromwell.
Yes.
I have always suspected for years, partly one reason that sort of led us to do this, that when Wolsey fell, which was largely Anne's doing anyway, and the Boleyns doing, as Jean du Bellay, the French ambassador, actually says, it's the Boleyns that are doing this and have done this. After Wolsey falls, Anne is the interim chief minister because Cromwell does not become, Cromwell starts out as Henry's parliamentary manager, doing a bit of fixing here and there in Parliament. He is not, no, by no sense of the imagination, is he remotely equipped to be chief minister until the very, very, very earliest, after Thomas More's fall as chancellor in 1532.
Yeah.
But in fact, actually, I mean, an American scholar noticed probably about 15, 20 years ago that when Cromwell was made vicegerent in spirituals, that means deputy supreme head of the church. Vice, because it's the number to two, you like a vice head. Gerent, because it's from the Latin gero, meaning doing things. Vice gerent of in spirituals, so like deputy supreme head of the church. He gets two commissions. The first one that everybody lights on is only for the investigation of the condition and wealth of the monasteries. The one that gives him full powers in a grant modelled word for word on the papal legacy, the papal plenipotentiary powers that Pope Leo gave to Cardinal Wolsey, comes immediately after Anne's fall in 1536. It's after Anne's fall that Cromwell really becomes the chief minister. He also becomes Lord Privy Seal and gets a whole lot of new powers. But I think that what happened was, you see, Henry and Anne, as Julia says, they were determined to get this divorce. Henry was determined to marry Anne and to do so in a way that meant that any child that they might have, and in a particular son, would be legitimate. And so they're working together on this joint enterprise as a team, pulling every possible string and every possible connection to get this. Then he gets it.
Yes.
And then suddenly it is, do I really want to let go of this power? Do I really? Because, of course, again, we've sort of looked into Henry's backstory. And the thing about Henry is that superficially he seems very secure. But psychologically and underneath, he's actually very insecure.
And you can see all sorts of incidents in his childhood that would cause that.
And when he meets opposition to Anne and opposition to the divorce, he becomes something of a control freak. And the key, Richard Rex has pointed this out, and he's an important Tudor historian in Cambridge, and Reformation historian in Cambridge. The maxim that's most important to Henry is obedience. Obedience from his subjects, obedience from his courtiers, obedience from all around him. You know, he's only got to say, as I think it's Hussey says, he's only got to say the word
once,
well.
Yes, and once, twice, thrice.
And then, for people to know that he's in business and you don't argue with him, he just says, now, well. And then that's it. You know, you've got to be careful.
That's right. Because he's decided, so don't say it.
Then he says, now, once, twice, thrice, you know, you're in trouble.
That's right.
And I think he decided he just wasn't going to, and he didn't need to. When he needs the money, He needs the money from the smaller monasteries. And he tells Jane Seymour the same. Jane Seymour only once tries to sort of basically intervene. And Henry says, watch out, you know, matey, because if you talk like that, you'll end up like the queen that's just basically been, sent off to execution. Of course, Jane never mentions that again. And I think that's basically the story. And I mean,
he was madly in love with her. Yeah.
He was madly
and
in
I
love,
don't
but,
think you
But
can...
was she in love with him? And I mean, the thing is that, you know, how was, is this, this relationship actually is, when you really sort of think about it, is actually also quite transactional.
Yeah.
You know, I'm madly in love with you. And I'll give you the son. I'm the one that you've got to marry me, but I'll give you the son. And so it's like, there's a transaction.
It's a bargain.
There's a transaction here.
I mean, I don't think you can get away from the fact that Henry is madly in love with her. If you read those love letters, 17 of them Vatican archives, that's all I was going to say here. But I think it's very important. I find them actually almost endearing. He does bare his soul. He really does. He can't bear to be away from her. The way in which he puts little hearts on some of the letters with her initials in the middle.
As if he's carving them on a tray.
Absolutely. rather like some sort of Shakespearean thing where you see it. He really does adore her. There's one when she gets the sweat and he actually says, oh, you know, if I could, I would bear half of it for you. Well, it's easy enough to say because he can't. But Henry had a pathological fear of illness before he even ever went to Calais, for example, which was then an English possession. And he went over a few times. He would insist on very, very detailed reports on the level of sickness that was there. And, you know, he practices, once the sweat comes, you know, he practices his own form of lockdown and, I don't know, social distancing, because he won't go near anybody and rushes away. But he is so involved with Anne that when she gets the sweat, they wake him in the middle of the night to tell him she's got it. Is she so madly in love with him? Well, that's another matter, isn't it? I think it's a very, very difficult one to answer, if I'm really, really honest. I don't think so, however. She is born to marry up.
Exactly.
I mean, that's what you were going to say. Yeah. She is born to marry up. And you can't get more up than the king. But I think there is something that does make you start to wonder. Very, very famously, Henry and Anne sent sort of almost like little love notes to each other in their prayer books, which I'm sure a lot of your readers will know. And they've probably seen some of these in repro. But if you actually look at what they are saying, what Henry says is, I'll read this out because I want to get it absolutely spot on right. If you remember my love in your prayers, as strongly as I adore you, I shall hardly be forgotten, for I am yours, Henry Rex, always. And what does she do? Unless she did hers first, of course, which is a possibility. She says, by daily proof you shall me find to be to you both loving and kind. It's not quite on the same level, is it? Mm. It's almost like the love, honour and obey that women, that women owed to their husband in the marriage services, marriage ceremonies.
Which then was love, serve and obey.
Yes.
It later got changed to love, honour and obey.
Yeah, it was love, serve and obey. Yes, you're quite right. Okay, she puts hers, it's quite deliberate too, that hers is written below a depiction of the Annunciation. You know, when the angel Gabriel tells the Virgin Mary she's going to give birth to a son.
The transactional element.
The transactional element. So I think, yes, he adores her and she will go along with it. Although I don't know that she would ever have thought what it would be quite like to live with this person. You know, it's all very well. You're going to get married. Then what? You're going to see him a lot for a start. Yeah. How are you actually going to function on a more day-to-day basis? Mm. And of course, it's an unequal marriage. It's not like a marriage that you can just say, well, you know, it's the same as one today. It isn't, because they are so unequal.
She's a commoner who's promoted through her
he's
father.
He's a king who's married down, if you're thinking of it that way. And I think the fact that they are working together to a common aim means that once that aim has gone, they've got the equivalent of the divorce in a sense. She is married. She's not produced the child. Well, where's the sense of common purpose now? And Henry needs that son.
But he's still, he's still with her. And I mean, it's still strong. That bond is still very strong.
It's very much a last minute decision.
So we're not sort of in any way trying to sort of winch this down, but we're just trying to sort of get a sense of its real dimensions. I mean, I think the register, as Julia says, the register of what Anne says, you know, is very much what a dutiful wife is expected to say to her husband on her wedding day when she's marrying up. And it's not the sort of statement of passion that, you know, you would expect. And I mean, the choice of Anne knew her iconography. I mean, she knew when she chose that page, you know, she didn't write it just on the same page as Henry, as most people would. I mean, she chose a different page.
I mean, I think to be absolutely fair, we have got to say that the 17 love letters that remain are all Henry's. Sadly, we have none of Anne's. So we don't know what she said. You can guess a lot of it from what Henry says in reply.
But it took her a year. It took her a year. I mean, he complains it's taken her a year. Or when she does come round, it's taken, you know, this has taken a year. I've been packed with the pangs of love for a year.
With the dog,
you know, she wants to think about it. And I mean, the family, the Boleyn family, has to have been involved in this.
Yes.
And Thomas Boleyn would have been pushing, you know, but this was the supreme catch. That's what the Boleyns had done since, you know,
since Anne's
great grandfather's time.
Yeah.
You marry up through the through the system.
But it also means that when Anne falls, it seems to be very difficult to explain how Henry could then sort of go into the execution of this woman whom he absolutely adored. But he did. She at one point thought he was testing her, you know, and on the scaffold she kept looking round over her shoulder, probably hoping, well, it could be because she didn't want to see the blade come, I don't know, but it could equally be because she expected a last minute pardon. But Henry's not like that. She didn't know her husband, if that's what she thought.
So why do you think that Henry felt his actions were justified when it comes to Anne's execution?
Once the die is cast, he believes her. And I think this is genuinely true, don't you?
He believes she's guilty.
He genuinely believes that she is guilty of having a sexual relationship with the four commoners and the incest with her brother. He's convinced that this is so. And Anne's own words and her actions, you know, the intermingling, what she'd learned in France about the men coming into the Privy Chamber. She overstepped the mark on many occasions herself.
Well, I mean, within 6 weeks of her fall, there'd be a big sex scandal involving Margaret Douglas, which was going on for a year. I mean, this was another one of our little finds this was to some extent known about. But of course, when you get down to National Archives at Kew and look up the original manuscript, you get the Thomas Howard's original confession.
Yeah, it's something called the Devonshire manuscript, which is a bit like a sort of scrapbook being passed around by a small group of Anne's ladies: Mary Shelton, Mary Howard, Margaret Douglas. Margaret Douglas is the king's niece who'd been entrusted to Anne's care, and Anne liked her. They got on terribly well, but 6 weeks after Anne's fall, Margaret Douglas and Thomas Howard are arrested because basically they've been having hanky-panky.
Steamy hanky-panky
at court while Anne was in charge.
And that's the crucial thing because, in fact, the confession, not in the Devonshire manuscript, but in the confession, which was taken by one of Graham Cromwell's sidekicks, we know that Thomas Howard, waited for my Lady Boleyn. That's Lady Elizabeth Boleyn, the aunt that Anne didn't like, to leave her chamber in Anne's innermost side of the court,
and then
to leave her bedchamber and to go off. And then they would nip in for a bit of hanky-panky.
Yes.
And Mary Howard and Margaret Gamage were accessories and sort of helped one and help them. And that sort of tells you lots of things, because this affair had been going on for a year. Within 6 weeks, and Anne.
I don't think Anne knew about it.
You probably didn't know about it,
but that's not good either.
It shows she wasn't keeping sufficient discipline in the Privy Chamber. Yeah. That things had got a little bit too lax in there. But it also shows that the impression that Howard had also was that Lady Elizabeth Boleyn was somehow the police woman.
Yeah.
You know, keeping order in Anne's household. So when she wasn't there,
not the Queen.
The Devonshire manuscript has long been known by literary scholars.
Yes.
I think the thing is that more recent work shows that some parts of it were written while Anne was earlier.
It went on for long after.
And ended up with Margaret Howard. It started with Mary Howard.
Yeah.
But we talk about this. You can't make too much of it, but it's very much part of this story.
Well, it's part of what was going on in the chamber. It has poems poems written in it. It has almost like little comments on a poem is written to Mary Shelton.
But they're sexy. They're sexy.
And, yeah. And they're saying, well, what do you think of this sort of chat? You know, it's almost like girls talk. And girls night out.
There's banter. In which they answer each other. And
we don't know when all of that was going on. And you can't make too much of it, as John says. But it was going on. And it gives a bit more bottom, if you like, to some of the charges that start to be levelled when Anne falls, doesn't it?
And she talks a lot in the tower, of course.
She babbles in the tower.
After all, I mean, the names of Smeaton, Weston, and Norris. I mean, you know, confirmed by the incidents which Anne talks about. And she says, well, these are sort of innocent banter or just basically banter in the Privy Chamber. And they were not, there was nothing really behind them. But when put in the right way, it doesn't necessarily look like that. And of course, then I think a crucial episode too is the fact that there's absolutely no doubt, because of what was read out in the court subsequently, that Anne had told Jane Parker, you know, Lady Rochford, that Henry was no good in bed.
Yes.
That he had neither puissance nor force. He had neither power nor force. Some sort of perhaps erectile dysfunction or something. Mm. I mean, George was told not to read it out, but he did read it out.
George was.
But of course, if Cromwell knew this to put in the paper, then he knew about it.
Yes.
So Henry knew about it. Yeah. And Henry, I mean, he even writes this tragedy. You know, and he tells everybody Anne was going to poison his daughter Mary. He was going to poison Fitzroy. He probably poisoned Catherine of Aragon.
Catherine of Aragon.
And I think also, and another point is that all these allegations caused a great deal of turmoil and discussion. But it's the king's household, because the Queen's household is a department of the royal household, which is all ultimately the King's household. And so when you have all this talk, it's as if the King can't keep order in his own household, which of course the logical conclusion of that is that he may not be fit to rule if he can't keep order in his household. And the reason that I know this was particularly powerful for contemporaries is because I'd also come across the same thing with Mary Queen of Scots. When Elizabeth's Privy Council, William Cecil and his friends decided to send the warrant for Mary's execution, which Elizabeth had signed, but then basically recalled. Don't send it yet. Hold on to it until I tell you it can go. But they sent it anyway because they wanted her dead. And they resolve in Cecil's chamber, private chamber, not the council chamber. They almost signed a sort of covenant not to tell the Queen until the deed is done. And Elizabeth goes ballistic. And there's a Star Chamber trial, and her secretary, William Davison, is put on trial for letting the warrant out of his possession. And Lord Lumley, who's a Conservative peer, who's a member of the Court of Star Chamber, says at one point, can't the Queen keep order in her own household? You know, can her secretary go off and basically do stuff on Italian? Can't she keep order in her own household? If she can't, she's not fit to rule. That's your gut reaction. Mm. And I think Henry would have felt that very keenly, quite apart from the fact that, I mean, the clever touch is the incest, because it's so scandalous.
Yes.
There's another thing that we sort of unearthed, which we're not sort of wanting to make too much of, but it's there all the time, is that, of course, notoriety in your county or in your area was actually a reason in the Middle Ages for bringing a prosecution at law. A criminal prosecution at law, even without, in some cases, without a sort of proper formal indictment or witnesses.
Yeah, the sort of no smoke without fire type idea.
And at one point, when admittedly, it's a debate about the treatment of heretics by the church courts, but where they did use inquisitorial procedure, and they did, ecclesiastical judges, church judges, did make decisions about heretics without necessarily hearing sort of proper accusations or, you know, I mean, detailed accusations from named individuals. Moore says that actually this does happen in the church courts in notorious cases. But he says, but it can even happen in the secular courts in a really notorious case. And there was a couple of cases in the Middle Ages where people were basically sent to the Tower or executed for serious crimes or corruption on the basis of the notoriety and ill fame in the country. So it's not totally alien. It's alien to our mindset. Of course, it's in the Mort d'Arthur. It's in Malory's Mort d'Arthur also.
Which they would have read.
Which they were all reading. So again, we're not making too much of that. But I mean, I don't think there's any doubt that, and of course, for Henry also, you know, by then, You know, he's going around saying, you know, I trust no man but myself. Mm-hmm. I'm not listening to women anymore. You know, I'm not even necessarily listening to counsel. I trust no man but myself. And for him, obedience becomes the main thing. And he sees Anne as a disobedient wife. And he's, you know, this passion. I mean, this can happen, can't it, in relationships that go wrong. This passion can turn to a sort of violent, murderous hatred. We sort of almost do the countdown. The way in which, you know, we don't think this is a simple Cromwell coup. It's Henry who makes the call. Cromwell sort of helps things along. Henry by then has opened up a bidding war between France and Spain as to who's going to give him the most or support him the most. And he'll go with that one. He may ditch the French alliance, but he's far from decided to do so. Who's going to make the call? And this is going on. And then he discovers right at the, and Cromwell's then spices it up, of course, when this opportunity comes with Norris and, you know, the reports of what was said. And by then, not only has Anne got hostile people in the career quarters in her side of the court, but also a woman like Marjorie Horseman has gone over to
him. They're switching sides. They can see which way the wind is blowing.
I mean, about 6 months before Anne's fall, she starts looking to Cromwell for patronage and not to Anne. This sort of, and of course, Margaret Coffin was always one of Catherine's supporters and Lady Kingston. And I mean, they can tell everything to Cromwell. This thing gets through and it just explodes.
It does. But Henry makes
this choice when right at the last minute, he finds out that in Rome, where Charles has arrived in Rome, he's been coming up from the south, up towards Rome with an army. And the ambassador with Charles writes in and tells Henry that Charles is thinking of enforcing Pope Paul's decree of excommunication and deprivation of Henry's kingdom. And Charles is thinking of doing this. And France, the French agents in Rome, are making no objection. So Henry now knows this. He's got to make a choice. And he decides that he'll go back to the original. And then in those circumstances, Anne has to go. And even if you think Charles actually, at the end, Charles, again, I mean, I never knew any of this stuff. I don't know. I mean, Julia may have done, but you know, I've been teaching sort of all of this for years. But I never knew until we were writing this book that Charles even offered to, as an olive branch to Henry, if he would renew the alliance, to allow Anne to stay as queen. She had to give up her reforming tendencies. And she also had to accept that Elizabeth would never be the heir, that it would be Mary, Catherine's daughter, who would be the heir. And of course, Anne would never have agreed to that.
Well, it's been so fascinating hearing you both talk about this book. And again, I highly recommend people, of course, buy the book and read the book for all the details. It's been so wonderful. There is just one more thing that I would like to ask you both. So I ask all my guests for a takeaway. So a Tudor takeaway, something for our listeners to go off and explore after the episode. So sometimes people suggest books, websites, music to listen to. Do you have a takeaway for us?
Well, I think what we would now say is that because the 17 love letters have been digitized and you can find them on the Vatican Archives,
Vatican Library website.
Yeah. I think that would be wonderful for people to actually see them in the original. I think that would be glorious. And oh, I've got to say this because it has always stayed in my mind from when I was a very young woman. The good old Anne of the Thousand Days. With Genevieve Bujold and the wonderful Richard Burton, Anthony Quayle, gets a lot of this right, actually.
Not the end, of course.
Not the end. When Henry, you can see why they do it dramatically, when Henry goes to visit her in prison and offers her her life if she'll basically give up Elizabeth's right to the throne. Not that bit, no. But as a sort of flavour of a lot of the period, I think it's wonderful. I remember watching it. We watched it, didn't we, not that long ago, actually. And we were quite surprised with, it has got lots of things wrong with it and it has got inaccuracies, etc. But some of it is really, really rather good.
As long as you know it's a theatrical representation. Yeah. I think, I mean, sort of years ago, I would have said, no, this is all full of mistakes or you could, but you, that's not the way to look at it. It's a theatrical entertainment.
Yes.
And, you know, I'd sort of learnt more about this when my Mary Queen of Scots Life got made the basis of the 2018 Hollywood film.
Yeah.
Mary Queen of Scots with Saoirse Ronan as Mary and Margot Robbie as Elizabeth. I mean, in that, towards the end, I mean, Elizabeth and Mary meet because in a theatrical representation,
they have to.
They have to. you can't get away from that. That is the nature of the genre.
Yes.
You know, and if you can't sort of accept that, there would be no cinema doing any sort of film of this sort.
No.
Actually, I mean, it was in some ways more justifiable in the sense that I had found quite near the end that actually there was the possibility of a last minute meeting, which is sort of in one of those watch this space things, because that will, I think, sort of be the big reveal before too long. The Anne of a Thousand Days, it's got a lot of moments,
and you know, for a very pleasant, I don't know, a couple of hours, why not? But have a look at the love letters,
and we'll send you the link.
Yes, yeah. Thank you. I will add the link because I know it's a tricky one to find. So we'll add it to the show notes. That'll make it nice and easy. And I love Anne of the Thousand Days. It's one of my absolute favorites. So I'm so happy. I'm so happy you suggested that. And I have to thank you again for taking the time to come and speak to us and tell us all about your book. It's been an absolute pleasure.
And for us, I think, too.
Thank you. Thank you, Natalie. Thank you.
Well, that brings us to the end of this episode of Talking Tudors. Thank you so much for joining us. I absolutely love to hear from listeners, so if you have any comments or suggestions, or just want to say hi, please get in touch with me via my website, www.onthetudortrail.com, where you'll also find show notes for today's episode. If you've enjoyed the show, please share the podcast with friends and family, and don't forget to subscribe, rate, and review. I also invite you to join our Talking Tudors podcast group on Facebook, where you can interact with other Tudor history lovers and hear all the behind-the-scenes news. You'll also find me on Twitter. My handle is On The Tudor Trail, and on Instagram as The Most Happy 78. It's time now for us to re-enter the modern world. As always, I look forward to talking Tudors with you again very soon.